the shyness that is criminal and vulgar. I'm son of man, but nothing in particular. Bishop Chimel, how can you say I go about things the wrong way?
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon.
And welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. Our guest today is Jaime Martinez, the community defense organizer at Casa San Jose. First question, Jaime, is, what is Casa San Jose?
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and to be speaking to folks on the radio. Casa San Jose is a resource center for the Latino community here in southwestern Pennsylvania. We were actually founded in 2013 by a sister of St. Joseph, Sister Janice Vanderneck. It began with her seeing that a community was under-resourced and there was no real space in the community to be addressing those needs. So she said, yes, I want to do something, and started finding solutions. Put her ear to the ground with two other people in the basement of a Lutheran church and figuring out what folks need and delivering solutions. Since then, 12 years later, we have expanded to over 35 employees. We have social workers. We have an organizing and advocacy program. And we have really established ourselves as the go-to source of support for underserved Latinos in the community.
You now serve, I think, around 6,000 people a year?
Yeah, that's right.
And what kinds of things do you do for them?
So that's anything from, I need help with groceries, I don't know how I'm going to make rent, to I need to get my child a passport. All of those kinds of services we are really good with. We have also been good with connecting folks to legal services, helping them to develop sustainable solutions to any financial issues they may have and working through that with them. And beyond that, in the time that we find ourselves in now, we are working on community defense, which is kind of where I come in, right? We've seen the news. We've seen how the Latino community and the immigrant community at large is being scapegoated, is being demoralized, and we are at the forefront of making sure that folks' rights are protected, that we are engaging and organizing the community in a way that celebrates and includes our immigrant community and trying to build power.
So I know Casa San Jose runs Know Your Rights sessions for immigrants to the United States.
So Know Your Rights sessions are what happens if you have an interaction with law enforcement? What happens if immigration enforcement shows up at your house, at your workplace, or stops you in your car, stops you in public? What can you expect? What do they look like? How can you respond? These are the kinds of sessions that we've been having all across Southwest PA over the past 4 months, basically. We've had over 50 sessions since the beginning of the year, and we've served more than 800 people.
So if ICE comes knocking on somebody's door, what should they do?
A few things on that. At large, I think a common refrain that I use that folks should internalize is that ICE preys on the ignorant and the isolated. folks that are walking alone, that are walking to work alone, that live alone or that drive alone, that don't have support networks in the community, that are isolated from their community. That's a prime target for ICE, because they know that if they grab that person, if they abduct that person, because that's what's happening, no one will know that they're gone. And that's better for them, because it'll grind down the person's humanity and make them more likely to sign deportation papers once they're in detention. ICE will prey on ignorant folks, folks that don't know their rights. They will show up in packs. They will always outnumber the people that they are looking for. We've seen an average of like 4 to 7 agents showing up to an interaction looking for one person, and that's for one person. We have seen as many as 17 agents showing up to a single family home, all of them armed, one of them with an AR-15. So they will look to be aggressive, provoke, intimidate, manipulate, and they will try to get into your house. So what's really important, going back to your question, is you should never open the door. You should ask them through the door to identify themselves. That's full name, badge number, what agency they're with, why they're there. And then if they want to get in, if they want to talk to you, they need a judicial warrant. Tell them, I need to see a signed warrant by a judge. If they don't have that, you should not open that door and implicitly give them access into your home. If they do make it into your home, if you do open the door for some reason, very important that you speak the words, I do not consent to this. I do not consent to this search. I do not consent to you being in my home right now. That's a key legal phrase that kind of harkens back to the Fourth Amendment, the right to refuse unreasonable searches or seizures. Exactly. Right. That's right. So you got to tell folks, I do not consent. And that Fourth Amendment protection is strongest in the home. And you should not let them in without a warrant signed by a judge.
Sounds like people from other countries legally do have rights in the United States.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I just had a great conversation with a lawyer from the ACLU about this yesterday out in Philadelphia. When it comes to things like the First Amendment, we were talking more about the context of people protesting and their rights with the First Amendment. It's not completely settled as to whether non-citizens have like the full breadth of First Amendment rights. Many courts have established that that is the case, that if you are here in the U.S., if you are on American soil, you have access to those constitutional rights, and those are very broad. But President Trump has appointed many judges that may have different opinions, and these cases haven't been tested too much. So we might see a new flurry of cases coming to a different set of judges in this era that might give us different responses. But broadly speaking, we should act as if, yes, we do have those protections and hope for the best.
Sounds like what you're saying is prior to 2025, case law had established the precedent that foreign nationals in this country legally were also protected by the United States Constitution, but now...
Right. So, yes, that's right. Like, it's, how would I put it? Everybody who is on American soil, documented or undocumented, regardless of legal status, has access to these rights. Now, what we're seeing on the news, on tape, here in Pittsburgh, is that what is our rights on paper, what are our rights on paper, and what is actually being respected in a situation are two very different things. We can have a whole conversation about what the law says and what we should do, and then there's what is actually happening and what you should do in response to what is actually happening. So that's another kind of situation as well.
What should an immigrant do if confronted by people in ICE vests on the street as they're getting out of their car and walking into their apartment?
What we've been seeing is the likeliest scenarios, at least here in southwestern Pennsylvania, is ICE showing up in the parking lots of businesses, being out in public. And so somebody will be driving into work, and then when they park their car, like it'll be like a restaurant, when they park their car, suddenly 4 unmarked police vehicles come out of nowhere and block the car from leaving. And then 6 officers come out and swarm the car. Just a few weeks ago, a 22-year-old guy gets grabbed out of the car, thrown on the ground. We believe he might have been tased, and then is put in handcuffs before he is asked to produce identification, all with his partner in the passenger seat. So that's the kind of thing that we're seeing. They're in public. They are waiting outside of places that they think people that they're looking for will be at. And so they're not going into the restaurants and asking for folks. They're waiting outside and waiting for folks to leave work alone, folks to show up in the early morning, or they'll be waiting outside people's homes as they leave to go to school, to work, etc. If you're confronted by them, number one, it's always important to have a buddy with you. If you feel unsafe, if you feel that you are prone to being targeted, having a buddy with you is important. Additionally, you're going to want to, again, ask them for full name, badge number, what agency they're from. Do they have a warrant?
It's more like, may I see your warrant?
Yes, correct. Well, sometimes they don't have a warrant, right? And they'll say they do, but then they never show a paper. So trying to take a picture of the warrant, trying to get somebody to see that something is happening to you, stating your name to someone, all of that stuff. We want somebody else to know that you are being abducted by ICE. Because what we've seen a lot is somebody gets picked up in the dead of night. No one knows for 3 days where the person is. And then somebody at work will start asking questions like, hey, they're not showing up to work anymore. I wonder what happened. And then it becomes a passing thought. And then suddenly folks are forgotten about. We don't want that. No person in our city should be forgotten about. We want to hold each other accountable as good neighbors. So we want to make sure that if someone's detained, we know that they've been detained.
You used a loaded word there, abducted. But that is, I guess, what you're saying is happening. If there's not a warrant being shown.
Yeah. So I want to maybe provide a little bit of color to our listeners. ICE does not show up like a police officer with a friendly knock at the door and say, hey, like, we're here to detain you because you did this and that. That is not what's going on. What we're seeing instead are folks in hoods and masks. They are masked, like with ski masks. Black ski masks, wearing all black or wearing like camo, showing up to houses while it's still dark outside, before dawn, furiously knocking on doors, trying to batter down doors, and asking for somebody to come out. They will not say who they are a lot of the time. They will not identify themselves. We have specifically heard that some ICE agents will say, I don't want to identify myself because I don't want to get doxxed. That's the kind of scenario that we're seeing. They're not identifying themselves. They are not saying that they are immigration enforcement. They will call themselves the police when they are not the police. They'll say they're investigating a criminal matter. Sometimes they're recently here in Allegheny County, we've seen that they are posing as CYF, child, youth, and family workers, saying that they want to do a welfare check on an unaccompanied minor and then ask the sponsor for their documents and then arrest the sponsor. That's the sort of thing that we've been seeing. And then they will grab somebody. I mean, we've all seen the videos. They pick somebody off the street. They pick somebody from their front door. They will become aggressive. When they ask for why are you arresting this person? Why is this going on? We're arresting them for immigration. I'm sorry, what the heck does that mean to be arresting somebody for immigration? That makes no sense. They take them to the ICE processing office at 3000 Sydney Street on the south side. And then they will book them as if they were in a carceral system, take their picture, take their fingerprints, interview them as to who they are and identify them. And then because we have a team of attorneys that will go down and try to make contact with these folks, we will get stonewalled by ICE agents. An attorney will go down and say, I need to speak to my client. They'll say, oh, we haven't identified if they're here or not yet. And they know damn well that they're there. But they say, oh, we can't tell if they're here or not. Come back later. It's going to take hours to identify them. A few minutes later, we'll get a call from the person who's in that office detained to their family saying, hey, I'm here. Like, I'm okay. That family will call us and say, hey, like, I can confirm that they're there. By the time we're back there, oh, I'm sorry. We already transferred them out of this office. They're in a detention facility now. They go to a detention facility in rural Pennsylvania, Moe Shannon Valley Processing Center. It's a private for-profit prison is what it is. It used to be a private for-profit federal prison. And then they reskinned it as an ICE detention facility when President Biden signed an executive order banning the renewal of these contracts. ICE pays the GEO group, which runs this place, $3 million per month base pay. Then on top of that, a per head daily rate. You have folks being detained for having or not having a piece of paper, being forced to force upon them self-deportation papers, keeping them in detention cells, not letting them be with their friends and family. They are not a danger to society. They do not have criminal records. They've been here for sometimes decades. They are members of the community, workers, taxpayers, mothers and fathers, families. And, you know, rich people profit and rich people get richer. And the American promise is desecrated.
We are talking with Jaime Martinez, the community defense organizer at Casa San Jose. Is this a new situation? That has it really been escalated in the last year where people are targeted? And are they targeting specific groups? Is it just Latinos?
I think it's important to realize that this did not start on January 20th, 2025. This was happening during the presidency of Barack Obama. This is a bipartisan issue in the worst way possible, and no one seems to want to do anything about it. We've had many, many situations where the American public and the American political system has had the opportunity to fix what is very obviously a flawed immigration system that has only become extremely flawed as of recent. When the Italians were coming in, when the Irish were coming in, you know, it was open, Ellis Island. They right. were greeted by the Statue of Liberty, and right. there was no visa system. There was no backlog of 5 years and H-1B visas. You were on a boat, and you got in, and you were healthy enough, and they would maybe change your name to make it a bit more American, and you'd just be here, and you'd be an immigrant, right, because of your life story, but you would be here, and you'd have the chance to start a new life. That doesn't happen anymore. And the last time we had this sort of mass migration was 100 years ago. We know very well that as times change, so do our systems. And our system is not caught up for the way that the world works and the way that the transit of people work, how people move and migrate across the world. And folks have always known we have created, as Americans, the American myth of becoming a melting pot of diversity being our biggest strength, of immigrants being welcomed from everywhere. But the reality is that right now, that's not been the case. That's not been the case for a decade. And what we're seeing now is just the scab being ripped off. The Trump administration, Trump 2.0, is moving a bit quicker than the past presidencies have, but it's mostly a continuation and just an expansion. We've had many opportunities to do something. We haven't. We have been slipping further and further and further into authoritarianism, and we have permitted our country to get to this point. Let's remember that President Trump won this election, and his campaign was very explicitly mass deportations now. I think back very vividly to the picture of thousands of people holding mass deportations now signs. That platform won, whether we like it or not. So something within ourselves as a voting population as well, and as Americans in this country, is deeply flawed in our ability to find compassion and humanity within the immigrant community and within just people that don't look like us or think like us or speak like us. So I think it speaks to a broader compulsion that we need to kind of root out of ourselves in this moment, and we need to stand up and do something.
Of all the things that Mr. Trump promised during his reelection campaign, the immigration issue is the only thing where he's still polling positively, which speaks to, in my opinion, a problem with, you know, American society.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's a lack of education. I think we're all so deep in our algorithms on social media, we're in our echo chambers online, the news that we're reading and listening to. It's all very tailored to what we already believe. And then I also think with the decline of religiosity and the decline of third spaces where we meet people that have different political opinions but also share common ground in other respects, the lack of those spaces and the decline of these spaces has created a world where polarization is the inevitable conclusion. And that has created a lot of blind spots within ourselves, within the people that live across from us, that live in a completely different universe and that think that they are only picking up the rapists and drug traffickers and criminals or whatever and justify it like that. So I think there's a twofold issue here. One, we need to educate ourselves properly. The best way to do that is through relationship, right? It means getting involved. It means doing something. At CASA, we have many, many ways for folks to get involved. when you are able to witness firsthand the injustices that are taking place in our city, in our community, in our country, that is a radicalizing force. And I use that word radicalization very sparingly, but I think it's important to say it because it changes the way, it's transformative. It changes the way that you think about the issue and it urges you to act. The second half of this is we need to come together as a community and we need to learn from each other and we need to learn primarily from the folks we disagree with. I know it is so hard for folks to talk to folks across the aisle. It is so hard for us to withstand the uncle at Thanksgiving that just kind of spews whatever he sees on Newsmax, right? But if we don't reach these people at our kitchen tables, at dinner, at church, in walking out of our classrooms, in the late night dorm room conversations, we are never going to be able to change the way that our society is functioning. The antidote to all of this distortion of reality is human relationship. Humanity is our greatest strength. It is what makes us unique and beautiful. We have to play to our strengths. We have to see people as they are and lift us up together.
I'm thinking about my time teaching English as a second language to people from, you know, ranging from refugees from Iran to students from Malaysia, from different parts of Africa, different parts of Europe. And it was so invigorating to learn more about the world by talking to people who come from a different place than I do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the beauty of Pittsburgh and our city as well is that there is no real boundary to the kinds of folks that you're going to meet in your neighborhood. If you knock the doors on your surrounding three blocks over the course of a weekend, for example, just to introduce yourself, imagine the kinds of people that you would meet, the stories that people have. If you invited folks over for dinner one day, you might disagree on some things, but you will agree on so much more because we have so much more in common than what separates us. But we don't do that anymore. We are sticking our heads in the sand because of technology and big tech. And you know, it's not sticking our head in the sand, it's sticking our head into our screen, right? We need to return to our humanity, as you said, talk to folks that are different than us, find joy in what may seemingly separate us, but is what makes us unique. We have to celebrate these things. And we also have to stand up for those that are being actively marginalized right now, right? There's a lot to learn in the marginalized and the oppressed. So we have a responsibility, not just as Americans, not just as Yinzers, not just as CMU affiliates, but as human beings, to dig deep into that work.
It's always easier for people to point the finger at those who are different and view them as a threat. I don't know if you were even alive then when the Tea Party got started.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was one of their tricks, was to point at other people and say it's all their fault, while they kept funneling more money into more and more corporate pockets. I wonder how much of this crisis that immigrants are facing now in this country relates to that, that people have branded them as the problem. And so more people are tolerating what is going on with the immigration control.
Yeah, I would agree with that. People are also very busy, to add on to what you're saying. We do not live human-paced life, because how many times does your phone ring in the course of an hour or buzz? Me, probably like 50 times an hour. I'll get a little ding, buzz, I get a phone call, text message, news notification. There's things constantly happening. And so we become so distracted by what's happening around us and what's happening on our phones and what's happening in life that we forget to deal with looking up and looking around us and looking at our neighbors and investing in the work of our neighborhood. I think everything has to be extremely local. We freak out. Our heads are constantly on fire because of what we see on the news. I mean, Washington, D.C. is like new headline every day, and it just gets worse and worse and worse.
Every hour.
Right. Exactly. And that is a distraction from the broader issues that are right here in your neighborhood that you can directly impact. You cannot make any sort of impact on a conversation that the president of the United States has with the president of El Salvador right now. You can't. Unreachable. How are you going to get into the Oval Office? But you know what you can do? Respond to a call that ICE is in your neighborhood and record them and ask them why they're there and ask them to leave. That is something that you can do that will actually save families from being separated, that will prove to your neighbors that you care about them, that does the work of protecting the immigrant community, but that also does the deeper work, drawing from that well of human relationship. It's the work of community building, right? Showing folks around you that you care about them, investing in them, and that will ultimately solve a lot of the broader issues that we see in society. But it starts block by block.
We are talking with Jaime Martinez from Casa San Jose, where he holds the title of Community Defense Organizer. I am just curious what your reaction is to what's going on in the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who was deported from Maryland, even though he's here legally.
Well, it's terrifying, right? I was recently speaking at a teach-in, and something that they said was that human rights don't trickle down, they rise up. Great, great phrase. Human rights don't trickle down, they rise up. What that means is if one person in a room does not have the same rights that you do, in essence, it's not really a right. And if it can happen to somebody, it can absolutely happen to you. So let's think about the lack of due process. Let's think about the family that is being affected. I mean, that prison in El Salvador,
it's brutal. It's brutal.
It's brutal, absolutely. And they gloat about how they are never going to get these folks out and about how they torture them. Like, we're in really, really, really bad territory. And now for the president to be talking about how we should be exporting American citizens to that prison as well. I mean, it's just a complete lack of care for the folks that are in this country and also for the humanity that is within each of us and the way we should be treating one another as human beings. So it's terrifying, but this is a red line. This is one of these moments, right, where the American public can say, I'm okay with this or I'm not okay with this. We have failed on this so many times. We have failed to say, I'm not okay with this and actually done something. This is another one of these moments. Are we going to do something or are we just going to say, wow, this makes me so mad, and then move on to the next story? That's the choice that each of us has.
Casa San Jose, are there other agencies like yours in the greater Pittsburgh area that can help foreign nationals and immigrants out when they run into situations with ICE?
We primarily serve the Latino community, but given just the nature of the situation, what's been going on, we've created a really robust rapid response network within Allegheny County and 20 minutes beyond county lines as of now. That might grow because we've been getting a great response. One thing I would encourage folks to do, broadly speaking, is we have a 24/7 ICE hotline. This is if you hear that anything's happening on campus, if you hear that anything's happening around the city, this is rumor, eyewitness. You saw something on social media, you heard something, you are being affected yourself, they're outside your door. Anything like that, call us. That number is 412-736-7167. Again, 412-736-7167. That number works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we dispatch trained rapid response team members to go out to a situation. We can get there within 20 minutes as of now. We're working to bring that down as more and more folks get onboarded. And we view what's happening. We record. We ask for details. We make sure that we have names and information of people that have been detained. And we have attorneys ready to activate and go down to the ICE office. It's very robust. So when it comes to immediately what happens to you if you get stopped by ICE, Casa San Jose kind of has the niche of being the rapid response that goes out. Now, beyond that, if you have questions about immigration law or like you need legal services or immigration services, any of that sort of stuff, JFCS, which is Jewish Family and Community Services, great resource right here in Squirrel Hill, I believe. And they are great partners and dear friends to CASA. Somebody else that I can think of off the top of my head, the Islamic Center of Pittsburgh has been very active when it comes to especially like the Muslim community. And we've seen what's been going on with the Muslim community and like the intersection with the pro-Palestine protesters that have been abducted, all of that sort of stuff. Oh, you can also research what's known as PIFUP. PIFUP is more on the legal end, but it's an initiative to provide like a public defender, in essence, to a person in deportation defense and removal proceedings. Currently, anyone who is in immigration court gets to have an attorney, but at their personal cost. So it's not like most of the time folks don't have an attorney because they can't afford one. PIFUP is the initiative to expand representation to everybody in immigration court, to create like a public defender's office for immigrants when they face these removal proceedings in immigration court. So you can kind of ask them. They have funding and resources to be able to solicit representation and counsel for you if you are in a situation. PERC is the Pennsylvania Immigrant and Refugee Coalition, I believe. They're also a great resource. All in all, there's a lot of different folks doing the work around here. Hello Neighbor is a refugee service here in Pittsburgh as well. Lots of great folks at the table doing a lot of good work and committed to the good fight.
I like that name, Hello Neighbor, because to my worldview, that's what this is all about.
Yeah.
You're my neighbor. Everyone's my neighbor.
That's exactly right.
I don't care if they're wearing a hijab or speaking Spanish.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And let's think about this. Like, especially in this neighborhood is where Fred Rogers taught us all to be good neighbors, right? He recorded just down the street and he taught us how to be good neighbors. He talked about what it means to be kind to one another, how to show up for one another. That's his legacy that he left in this city. That's the legacy that we all need to pick up right now in a moment so crucial as this one.
Jaime Martinez from Casa San Jose. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org. Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
You're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Archin Das, and today we're here with...
Erica Hyde. I'm a senior park ranger for the city of Pittsburgh. I work out of the Department of Public Safety.
And we're here to learn a little bit more about the deer management program in the city of Pittsburgh. Thanks for coming on the show.
Of course.
So tell us a little bit more. What is the deer management program?
Yeah, so the deer management program is a effort to control the overpopulation of white-tailed deer in the city of Pittsburgh limits, specifically looking into our parks, which will then result in benefits for our local residents around parks and throughout the city as a whole. So we were approached by a group of citizens within a neighborhood organization, primarily within the Friends of Riverview Park, which is up in the north side of Pittsburgh. And that was also joined by the Squirrel Hill Urban Coalition. And they kind of merged together and formed a group of concerned citizens, specifically between their two organizations, but also citywide, that were complaining about the effects of deer, primarily across the city, eating their vegetation, potentially being in vehicle collisions with deer. And they wanted to take that effort and that interest and formulate it into a deer management program. So when we met with them, we were basically just the people to help get that legislation through and also formulate a deer management program that was effective, but primarily safe for all of our park goers and citizens visiting the city of Pittsburgh. So,
sure. Within the deer management program, I think when most people think about a word like deer management, you're thinking about what seems like sort of science-y methods, sterilizing deer and such. Mm-hmm. But the deer management program in Pittsburgh actually involves hunting. Can you talk a little bit more about why that choice was made?
We evaluated both non-lethal and lethal methods for deer management as a whole. So we very early on looped in the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, to help us through this process. They are experts in it. They've been running deer management programs for way longer than we have. We also looked at other parks around us that match kind of our, you know, demographic and our acreage and whatnot. So we really like Cincinnati's model, and we basically took Cincinnati's model, worked with the USDA, made a couple tweaks here and there, and we came up with our solution. So right now in Pennsylvania, you cannot legally do any sort of non-lethal deer management. It's primarily, the big thing is it's not going to help handle the deer population that we have as of today. We are already overabundant. If we put in non-lethal methods, one, they're not going to be very effective. Two, they're going to be extremely expensive. But three, they're not going to handle the deer population we have right at this minute. And we need to bring that population down to a sustainable level, before we could even consider any sort of non-lethal options. But in the state of Pennsylvania, we can't do that. We can't do sterilization. We can't do trap and relocation. And we cannot do a birth control. It's not FDA regulated or approved in the Pennsylvania region. So we chose a lethal method. It was both cost effective. We could do some really great things with it, like donating to local food pantries and whatnot. And also it was handling the deer population that we had at this moment as a whole. So that is why we went with a lethal method versus the non-lethal method.
Cool. So you're a park ranger. What's the involvement of the park rangers in this program?
Yeah, so we are working in our parks every day. We're seeing the effects of overpopulation in terms of an environmental stance. So we're looking at the issues of an agricultural but also landscape issue. We're seeing our understory that's basically depleted. If you go, I don't know, Schenley is a great example. It's a local park here. If you go to Schenley and you're in the woods, you're on the Brattle Trail, you shouldn't be able to see clear to the Greenfield Road. You shouldn't be able to clearly see up to the Schenley Oval. We should have an understory. So I always tell people that go camping, go hiking. If you ever go up to McConnell's Mills, you see those lovely rhododendron forests. They're thick, but you can't see up to the next trail because that understory is so thick. Here in Pittsburgh, we don't have that. And that's because of the deer population. Our deer are hungry. They need food, and they're going to eat those understory covers. And without an understory, without a healthy understory, we're going to start seeing an increase in stormwater runoff and potentially even like landslides that lead to this. It's all basically a spiral of a demise. And when you add deer, an overabundance of deer as a whole to it, you're basically taking gasoline and pouring it on the fire. So this is one thing that we can manage now and help out our ecosystem as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, I've walked through Schenley Park many times. We live right next to the park. And I guess I never noticed that the sort of lack of vegetation on the ground is because of those deer. But you're saying that's like a major factor causing mm-hmm. that?
Yeah, it's a major, it's a major issue in Pittsburgh parks as a whole. And, if you ever walk through the park and you see new vegetation being put in or any sort of new trees, you see tree protection going on. You see tree tubes, you see tree caging, even deer fences and deer enclosures that are installed all throughout Frick Park to, give these trees a chance to even grow up, because our saplings can't grow without some sort of protection to keep them safe from the deer. And that even results in just natural seeding of the forest floor. Trees drop seeds, seeds hit the ground. Hypothetically, they grow new trees. Not in Pittsburgh, because the deer are right there to grab that sapling the minute it sprouts and eat it.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yes.
Cool. I'm sure a lot of people, after hearing this, maybe have the knee-jerk reaction that, oh, there's people, shooting guns and bows and arrows in my parks. But from what I understand, it's a very well-controlled and safe thing to do. Could you tell me a little bit more about the safety measures in place for this program?
Yeah, so for archery, everything that we do in our program has to be in line with the PA Game Commission, their regulations. And then in addition, we can add more measures to that as well. So anytime you're dealing with archery, you have to be 50 yards away from any occupied dwelling. So that's any sort of houses or whatnot. And then in addition to that, we added on playgrounds, dog parks, major amenities that we wouldn't want an archer to have to, deal with, conflicting with by any means. Archery has been happening for years and all around us. Allegheny County Parks has had a program that has had archers in it, in North Park, South Park, whatnot, for before I was born, before you were born, probably. So it's archery happens. It's happening all over, and it's a safe. We have a great track record from the Game Commission of hunting-related shooting incident reports from the last 20 years showing that archery is safe, especially for bystanders. The only injuries that typically occur from archery occur when there are alcoholic beverages involved, or multiple archers, or potentially falling out of your tree stand. Those were the three most common incidents that happen. So we did not allow our archers any sort of alcoholic beverages, obviously, and they had to hunt alone. So we didn't have that issue of being, distracted by your friend or, goofing off potentially. They had to hunt solo. And these archers, as they showed in their accuracy test, they've been out hunting before. They are very well-equipped with knowledge and the skills to handle this.
So has there been a noticeable decrease in the deer population? And how do you guys monitor this sort of thing?
It is tricky to study a population that is so transient and can move such a far distance. So we did not do a population study. We do not have a recent one because it would tell us we're overpopulated. You should not be able to go through a hike in Schenley Park and see 50 deer and be like, oh, another deer. You should be excited to see deer. A lot of times the number 20 to 30 deer per square mile is the quota that they look for. So that's one Frick Park, 20 to 30 deer. I saw 20 to 30 deer in 1 hour out on the trails in like one section of Frick Park. So we know we're overpopulated. There was no reason to do a study at that time. So we didn't.
You mentioned that there were different stakeholders in this program, the USDA, the city, different community groups. Could you just walk us through who are all of the different stakeholders and what's sort of their involvement in the program?
Yeah, so I work for the city of Pittsburgh. So the park rangers are lumped in the Department of Public Safety. We are currently managing the deer management program on the city side of things. So we're also dealing with public complaints, any sort of, you know, decision making is coming from the Department of Public Safety with assistance of City Council. Now, the USDA is a federal entity, and they're the ones proposing the contract, and it's signing through, you know, City Council with our opinions on it.
The deer management program runs during the winter. As far as I don't know a lot about hunting, I'm not like a hunting guy, but I always thought that it was during the winter in order to maintain the deer population. Is there a particular reason that the program is running through the winter and not, say, during the summer?
So once again, that's a state game, you know, game commission requirement. So we cannot change the dates. Our dates are set by county, and that's from the PA Game Commission. So they're always in the fall. My assumption, and I am not a hunter as well, my assumption is it has to deal with raising fawns. So obviously we don't want to take, you know, potentially a mother from a fawn at that phase. So this is before mating really begins.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. The archery program is finished for this year, right?
Correct.
Has it been a successful year, and where do you see it growing in the future?
So the archery program is completed right now. I believe it was a great success. We had zero public safety incident. We harvested 199 deer in total, and we donated 14,720 meals to those in need,
wow,
which is amazing. And with that, we're hoping to expand. We are finishing up the targeted harvesting now. We're going to debrief internally and with the downtown team, and we're going to see where we can expand to next season. So we're hopeful to see this program grow into a citywide program as we are starting to develop it into our five main parks, but hopefully more in the future. So
awesome. There was another part of the program that I found interesting. The first deer harvested by any archer has to be a doe. Could you tell me a little bit more about the reasoning behind that rule?
We require the first one to be harvested as a doe because we want the archers that are in our program to have the same mindset as we want this to be conservation driven. We want this to be, you know, population control driven. And we want to see some good come from this program. So if you're not willing to donate that first year, maybe this program isn't meant for you.
Walking around Pittsburgh, you also see a lot of forested areas that aren't necessarily parks, and presumably there are also deer living there. Are you guys planning on targeting any of those areas, or how do you approach that problem?
Yeah, so we are, I say as a city, we're putting our toes in the puddle of deer management. There's so many options, so many ways you can go about it, and the ways you can expand this program is endless, but we have to start somewhere. So right now, it was focusing on our larger parks that are typically residents for these deer. You know, they might wander out into the streets of Oakland, but where are they going? They're going back to Schenley Park probably to rest, you know, and resume, you know, their daily operations. But we can expand it. We can expand it to local greenways. We can even look into, I know the USDA does some work with residential owners. Like, there's so many options to expand a deer management program that we can look into. But right now we're only in year two, which is, you know, a great start. That's what we like to see. But we don't want to expand too fast. We want to, you know, work our way up to it.
So after doing a little bit of digging on the deer management program, I read about this new pilot program that's in place this year where there's like a targeted harvest with sharpshooters. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit more about that pilot program?
Yeah. So last year we introduced archery. This year we introduced archery in more parks, but we also added in a targeted harvesting aspect to the program. And targeted harvesting is only happening in Frick Park and Riverview Park up in the north side. It is contracted out by the USDA, so it's only USDA contracted employees that are coming in at night and they're removing deer. They are removing deer with firearms. They are suppressed. And they are doing this at night. So our parks are closed at 11 p.m. I don't know about you, but I'm not out past, 8 p.m., but they're starting closer to, they're starting at 11 p.m. or later, and they are working throughout the night, and they are off-site, out of sight by 6 a.m. when the parks reopen.
How many hunters are out there for the targeted harvesting program?
So it is just a one vehicle unit that is operating. So there are three guys within one truck. Someone spotting, someone driving, and then someone shooting. So, and they are obviously using thermals and nighttime vision to make sure that they have clean, safe shots before they ever take them.
I feel like that's like an interesting image to have in one's head of like a sort of squad that's just out there to shoot deer. So what have been some of the community reactions to this program?
Yeah.
You mentioned that there was some involvement from community organizations at the beginning.
Yeah, I would say I started this job in 2017, and I would say there was no way that we would have ever gotten a deer management program off the ground. The public was just not to that level of caring about the deer population. And in the last, 5 years, I've seen so many complaints, and the Gainey administration finally was like, we're going to do something about these complaints. We're going to handle the complaints about deer coming into our yards, eating all of our gardens. How many vehicle collisions we've had over the past, 20 years, just increasing. So the public really kind of fueled this program. Like, they were a large part of getting this program up and off the ground. So a lot of complaints that we had were more like curiosity. Like, how do I know that this is safe? I don't want to see an archer. I bring my kid there to the playground. Like, I don't want them to be exposed to this. And a lot of it was more just like, once you sat down and explained the program, everyone was totally understanding. And they want to see something happen with the deer population. They might be upset that it's a lethal control method, but once they understand that non-lethal is not an option at this moment, they're usually okay with it.
Could you talk a little bit more about the effects of the deer population on the plant life in the area?
Yeah, for sure. So, as I said, deer eat a lot, like 7 pounds of food a day. That's a lot of food for, Pitt did a study saying that they looked at the more economical side of deer management, but they made this prediction looking at prior studies that we might have up to 300 deer in Frick Park at a time. Take 300 and times it by 7. That's a lot of food being eaten every single day. So when deer are eating, they're munching on the native vegetation is what they prefer. That's what they want. They want our gardens. They want, our local or our native flora. So when they eat that and they remove it from the ground, because typically they pull and rip and they take the roots and everything with it, that leaves an open spot in our forest floor. Traditionally, what would happen is native seeds or whatnot would come in and fill that and hypothetically fill that void. But when we have 300 deer doing that at the same time, we're left with major gaps in our forest floor. So our ground has these gaps, and what's going to move in and fill that? It's probably going to be something that is deer resistant and traditionally an invasive species. So that's one of the reasons that we see things like garlic mustard, we see Japanese knotweed, and we see these species thriving in our parks because the deer aren't eating them. Nothing wants to eat them. So it's hard to replace once you start getting into, we're starting to spiral into more invasive predominant forest versus a native-based forest. And once you start that spiral, it's really hard to catch up. It's really, really hard to catch up. So we're seeing our native forest being replaced with more of an invasive-based forest cover or understory that the deer are not eating. And they're flourishing. They're doing great. But on the other hand, we see a deer population that's hungry, that's starving, and they're now starting to resort to moving out into the streets into risky environments or potentially even munching on invasive species that we have never seen them eat before. I saw a deer munching on Japanese knotweed in the middle of the summer, but that's what the food source was available for them.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Of course.
After speaking with Erica, we wanted to learn a little bit more from the perspective of the archers who participate in this program. We're catching up with one of them today, Walter Martin. Thanks for coming on the show, Walter.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't we start off with you telling us a little bit about yourself?
So I am an avid outdoorsman. I love being outside. I love hiking. I love going to the national parks. I like fishing. And I like archery hunting. So I love being outside. I love watching nature.
Sure. How'd you get into hunting and archery in the first place?
You know, I was, I used to be in a business development position in the golf industry. And with that, I was a lot of the places I would go, golf courses, were in areas that were, you know, woods, nice habitats. And they would talk about hunting and being like somebody who loved the outside. I just started to learn like what they were doing and I got involved.
So do you only hunt with bow and arrow or do you also hunt with guns?
I have only hunted with bow and arrow. So the bow and arrow season, the archery season is from September through November. And so it's a beautiful time of the year to be in the woods.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. So on the deer management program, I guess, how did you hear about the program in the first place?
So as you, you know, follow, you know, on Facebook, there's sites and pages that are dedicated to archery hunting. And it just came up in one of the groups. So I applied for it. You know, one of the challenges with archery hunting is trying to find places to hunt. And also places that are convenient.
Awesome. And within the city, where do you hunt? Which parks?
I hunt Frick Park.
Frick Park. Awesome.
So Frick Park, it's split up into 10 different zones, and a hunter is assigned to each zone.
Okay. So you can only hunt within the zone that you're assigned?
Correct.
Okay. That makes sense. So on a typical day when you're in the field hunting, just like walk us through your process. Like, what do you do to prepare when you're at home? When you show up, what do you do to set up? And like, what's it like? What kinds of hours are you maybe normally out there?
Since, you know, archery is fun and a sport, like we practice. So like really, when does it start? It starts in the spring as you practice and just keep getting better and better being archery and figuring out what you can do and what you can't do is what your limitations are. So it starts really with practicing and like moving forward as the season comes close. I would take walks in Frick Park around the area that I was planning to hunt and like see if I could see deer movement, see if I could see trails and prepare for that. If you're talking about like day of, like, you know, usually on Sunday, which is a non-hunting day throughout the state, I like will just double check my equipment to make sure that everything's fine and I'll just practice a little more. And then I'll have my gear in my vehicle. Like the day of, I'll show up maybe, you know, if it's early morning, I'll show up before the sun comes up and leave by, you know, an hour or two after the sun's up. I try to walk in with civilian clothing on, not camo. I carry a backpack and I have my hunting clothes in that. The bow, I hunt with both a compound bow and a crossbow. I carry those in a bag. As a big a plastic black bag. I pick up trash on the way, and I just try to not make anybody nervous. So, like, my pre-hunt, that's basically it. I do have trail cameras out there when they're allowed 2 weeks before the season starts.
Hunting deer in Frick Park is a little bit unique in that it's in the city instead of, you know, in a more suburban or rural area like most hunting that I think people are aware of. What are some of the differences between hunting in Frick Park and hunting sort of out in the woods in the middle of nowhere?
The deer feel bubbles of safety. And like on the trails, they know they're humans. And like the deer have been very comfortable around people. They were a lot more 2 years ago when it started than they are right now. But if you were within what they would consider their bubbles of safety, like in between the trails, in the woods, like they would get spooked when they saw people in places they didn't normally see people. I mean, that part's different. I think the real key is the approach to hunting. First off, safety's number one. So when we're scouting our territory, it's okay, this is going to be a good spot that's not going to endanger anybody. But we definitely know, okay, this is, I can shoot uphill here. If I'm shooting in an elevated position,
the arrow's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to fly. It's not like a gunshot, like a bullet that can travel a long distance. I don't think people realize we really don't shoot over 20, 25 yards.
Oh, pretty short.
Yeah, it's pretty short. And that's another huge difference in urban hunting. And especially with Frick Park and especially with this program, shot selection's unbelievably important. We have to look for a double lung shot that's going to put the deer down really, like, down quickly. In the wild, I've shot a deer that the arrow passed through its heart, and I think it still ran 80, 90 yards. If we're hunting in an urban environment and there's houses, you know, 80 yards can mean three or four houses. 80 yards can mean it runs towards the soccer field that the kids are practicing on.
Are you guys responsible for dressing the deer?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
So they have a station at all the parks where you would remove the deer and then field dress the deer.
Is this your first year in the program?
Second year.
Have you noticed any decrease in the number of deer?
Absolutely.
Okay.
A huge difference. The first year, deer would almost follow me in the woods. Yeah. Like, they were so docile. And there were so many of them. It's definitely dropped down.
So if you could nerd out a little bit, what gear do you bring on your hunts? What kind of bow?
So I have two types of bow, two bows that I bring. One is a Bowtech compound bow, and that's, you know, and one is a crossbow. Crossbows have higher power, and I think it has more downing. Like, it's, you know, for double long shots, it's probably something that would help put the deer down as soon as possible.
Could you talk a little bit more about the testing process? Do they take you out to a range somewhere? Or?
We go to a range. You know, there's target set up. You don't know in advance what your target is. You don't know the distances. So you guess and practice. Like, I practice farther than I would, like, shoot, like, in the field. Mm-hmm. So they have three separate targets, and you go there, and you get one shot in each, and you have to hit in a small window, and if you don't, you're out. Mm. I tried out both years. If you harvest a certain amount of deer, I think it was four, you were invited back, so.
How many deer would you harvest in a typical season?
So I think the average was about, you know, six or seven. So
out of on average, how many like trips do you think people are taking out to the parks in one season?
I think just off the top of my head, I think it was around, you know, 15 to 18. Candidly, I was a little more because I enjoy being out there.
Yeah.
So I love walking. So I would walk and just see what was going on. I'd jump in a tree and watch. And, you know, sometimes deer would walk under me. Like, it's like we are outside enthusiasts. So I saw a buck come out, and there was a raccoon that was around. The raccoon was walking up to the buck, and they were playful together, you know, and the buck, like, put his horns, like, it was like, and then the raccoon crawled up the tree and rested and flopped down in between three branches and fell asleep. And when it woke up 20 minutes later, it looked at me and its eyes got as big as saucers. It had no idea it was there. And then he, like, crawled away. But it's like, you see cool interactions like this. You see fox, you see, like, you know, birds. Like, it's just beautiful out there. So I think I was out there about 30 times.
Oh, that's awesome. So it seems like you enjoy participating in this program a lot. What's been your favorite parts of it so far?
So it's a combination of being out and, like, and again, enjoying the outside, enjoying, like, the sport of archery and of deer hunting. Part of the deer hunting too can be in part stalking and figuring out. It's almost like figuring out how are deer behaving? How is it different here? Like, what adaptions do I need to make here versus, like, being out in a state games land out in the middle of nowhere? You know, there's that. Honestly, it's also, you know, I do you know, intervention and treatment advocacy for people in drug addiction and alcoholism. You know, part of it's service to the city. You know, it's, you know, there is a problem. There are people like with car accidents and things like that, like that I just think like I can be a part of. And I think the, you know, the donations of hundreds of pounds of venison for the food pantries, I think is pretty cool. I feel really good about that.
So just to wrap us up, if you could tell our audience of people in Pittsburgh anything about the Deer Management Program that you would like people to know, what would it be?
First, I really appreciate the support of the people that I've walked, you know, like that I've, I feel like I'm a member too of the Frick Park community and how much support that we've gotten. I think we're feeding a lot of people, and I feel really good about that. Again, with my real job being in drug addiction and alcoholism, you know, I am by homeless shelters and I am by places that I know that they're getting, you know, good solid food and we're helping people out. Another thing, it's incredibly safe. We take 20, 25 yard shots. You're safe. You're like, your dogs are safe if there's on leashes. And I ran into a rabbi who was a little concerned because she saw a deer probably maybe like 60 yards away. She saw me. And she's like, you're not going to shoot my dog, are you? And I started through the process, and she was like, it's so safe. I go, yeah, you're totally fine.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on the show. You've been listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Today, we caught up with Walter Martin, one of the archers, participating in the Deer Management Program run by the City of Pittsburgh.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate you having me.
I'm going to go to the next one. I'm going to go to the next one.